Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so the first one here is, question is on metta practice. Metta bhavana, can it turn around your anger towards a person? Please comment. It can. It's good to practice metta bhavana to avoid anger. It is specifically said in the suttas to be the antidote to anger is metta bhavana. So if you want to avoid anger, then metta bhavana is the way to go. But remember that these are like antidotes. These are things that you do not when you're angry, but when you're not angry, right? When you're angry, it's already too late. You can't really do metta when you're angry. If you're already angry, you have to do one of these other methods we're talking about today. You have to try to turn away, to see the good side in the person, all these kind of things. It is when you're not angry, when you are at ease, when you're relaxed, when you're feeling good about yourself and others, that is the time to practice metta. So yes, it can help you with anger. Sometimes metta bhavana itself can often be a difficult practice. Not everybody is able to do it. It's about, you know, building up feelings of wishing other people well. It's not that easy. Many people find it hard. So very often we have to do all these preliminary practices. If you have anger towards a specific person, you have to neutralize that anger in other ways first of all. And that is part of what I was talking about today. You know, you focus on the good part of that person. You focus on compassion because that person is making bad karma for themselves. You remind yourself of the ownership of karma, right? These are all kinds of standard methods of turning away, turning anger away. And then once you have come to the point when you're able to forgive that person, let go of the anger, then you can try the metta bhavana as well. It's a very good thing to do. Often it takes quite a bit of effort and trial and error to be able to generate those feelings. But it's very, very worthwhile to do a bit of metta because it purifies you, right? And when you purify yourself, then the defilements decrease and then deep samadhi becomes possible. So a bit of metta, I recommend everybody to do that. It's also very useful on a retreat like this, because on a retreat like this, when you're quite close together with many people, it's very easy to irritate each other a little bit, right? Somebody does something you don't like, you get a bit irritated. But just reminding yourself of the good qualities of the people here, sending them a bit of metta and kindness, that is often enough to ensure that you don't get into any negativity during the retreat. Okay, dear Ajahn, according to the sutta we have done in the first day, which was Sanyutta Nikaya 45.1, that was the one about each path factor leading to the next path factor, I wonder how specifically wrong speech is a major cause for the arising of wrong action. Yes, that's a good point. I have wondered about that myself sometimes. Indeed, so delusion itself leads to arising of both wrong speech. Instead of delusion itself leads to the arising of both wrong speech and wrong action. What do you think about i.e. In that case, do you think there is a deeper sense for wrong-right speech, subverbal levels, etc., as sometimes Ajahn Brahm mentions? Again, can you say more about how wrong livelihood leading to wrong effort, as often wrong livelihood defines as just how a person sustains himself? Is there any more to livelihood than a wrong way or harmlessly earning a living? Okay, I get the general gist of the question. It is a good point. How does actually wrong speech lead to wrong action? Or how does right speech lead to right action? Is there any particular sequence there? And I must admit, I'm not entirely clear at that particular point, whether there is a sequence at that particular point. I don't know what it would be. It's not clear to me. There might be, but it's not anything that I have been able to discover myself. So I think the Noble Eightfold Path, there is a general trend of conditionality from the beginning to the end. But I think in the middle there, when we're talking about the virtue, the morality, the sila factors, I think basically they form like a group in the middle there. And it's very hard to, I think, pinpoint any general tendency there of one leading to the next one. When it comes to wrong livelihood leading to wrong effort, the point there is simply that wrong livelihood is the last of the three virtue factors, right? When you have got your livelihood right, the speech right, and the action right, basically you're purified as far as the external virtue is concerned, how we are acting with the world. At the next stage, once the external virtue has been purified, remember it's a gradual purification, right? You purify the coarse things first, it only makes sense. Just like the gold, the coarse things first, and then the more refined things. So when the external conduct has been purified, then you can start with the mental conduct. And that is why purity of livelihood leads to purity of effort, or rather right effort, I should say, because that is when the purification of the mind becomes possible. Right effort is nothing really but the purification of the mind. That's what it's all about. So there you're just seeing the gradual refinement of purification, essentially. Okay, I hope that makes sense. If I didn't answer that question properly, maybe you can write another one later on and we can try again. Okay, Dibanti. Ajahn Brahm often says that if Satipatthana is to reveal anatta, jhanas are a prerequisite. What about other lesser gains, i.e. Sokaparideva, Samatthikaya, etc.? The term Kanika Samadhi, where does it appear in the suttas? It does not appear in the suttas, but that is the first thing. Anyway, I'll do that one afterwards. I can talk a bit about that afterwards. The lesser gains, such as Soka Paridevana Samatthikaya, that is not a lesser gain, because Soka Paridevana Samatthikaya means the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation. And the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation only happens at arahantship, right? This is what it means. That's the final and complete overcoming here. So this is not a lesser thing. This is on a par with any kind of insight or any kind of benefit that arises from jhana practice. That's all the same. So this you're talking about now, the preamble to the Satipatthana Sutta, where it gives all the benefits, right? And these benefits are usually associated with arahantship. And the term Kanika Samadhi, it does not appear in the suttas at all. And that is, of course, very interesting. Nor does the term Upachara Samadhi actually occur in the suttas. All of these terms are post-canonical. They occur in particular, Upachara Samadhi occurs in the commentaries, it occurs in the Visuddhimagga, meaning the type of samadhi you have just prior to attaining jhana, which is called Appana Samadhi there. And Kanika Samadhi is even more rare. Kanika Samadhi occurs a couple of times in the Visuddhimagga, and then I think it occurs in the commentary to the Visuddhimagga. It's called the Visuddhimagga Mahatika or something like that. So that's where it really starts off. So these terms are not found in the suttas. Yes. Not sure what else to say about that. Samadhi in the suttas, the normal meaning of samadhi in the suttas is actually jhana. That's the normal meaning. Sometimes it means a bit more. It includes the things like the immaterial attainments, or it includes other types of samadhi like the sunyata samadhi or the that sort of samadhi. But generally speaking, it is the jhanas that are the most usual referent of the term samadhi in the suttas. Sir. Yes.
Bhante. Has written a long article on Kanika Samadhi.
Has he? Okay.
Saying where it comes from and what it is.
Oh, okay. Where is that? Who's published that one?
It was never published. I put it on my website.
Oh, it's on your website. Oh, okay, yes. Okay, so if you want to read about Kanika Samadhi, go to Venerable Metta Vihari's website. Which website is that again?
Metta.lk.
Okay. So there is an article there on Kanika Samadhi, written by Venerable Nanamoli. Venerable Nanamoli was one of the English scholar monks who lived, died in 1960, and he was actually the translator. He translated the Visuddhimagga, and it's considered a very difficult thing to translate, and apparently he did that very, very well, says those who know about it. So, anyway, next question here. This whole path is about ending the defilements. You do that by studying Buddha's teaching, one. Two, contemplating about your defilements and how to end them. Two, and the last one, three, while in meditation. Can you kindly elaborate? Okay. Yes, the ending of the defilements is a gradual thing, and yes, it is done by all these means. But in particular, the purpose of the training of Buddhism is to, first of all, gradually decrease the defilements until they disappear. Right? It's a gradual path. So you do it gradually, and you do all the means that you can use. Anything you can muster to do that, you will use in this practice. Includes studying the suttas, it includes contemplation, what you might call insight practice, you know, anicca, sanya, these kind of things. And it includes samatha practice, sitting down and just watching the breath. And includes the daily morality that you do. All of these things, everything that is part of the Noble Eightfold Path, decreases the defilements, right? And the idea is to reduce the defilements so far that there comes a time when the defilements are completely absent from the mind. That is the first stage. This is the first stage, like, of the path, reducing defilements until they completely disappear from the mind. And that is what we call samadhi. That's what we call jhana, when those defilements are completely gone. And it's only then that you have the chance to have deep insight. Deep insight can only happen as a consequence of the elimination, the temporary, I should say, elimination of the defilements. So when the defilements are down, then you have that golden opportunity to have some kind of insight. And it is those insights that you have when the defilements are gone, it is those insights that have the potential for eliminating the defilements once and for all. So it's like a two-stage practice, temporary liberation from defilements, and then on that basis you can do a complete elimination of the defilements. So that is how it works. But basically you do your best. This whole Eightfold Path is just about that. That's why it's called the Path of Purification. It's a very good word, actually. The path of purification, because that's really what it is. You purify yourself stage by stage. Okay, next one. I'll go a little bit fast because there are so many questions in here. So how does one participating in a retreat make progress in the Eightfold Path? Okay, well, this is what we're here for, right? This is what my teachings are all about. It's about making progress in this Eightfold Path. Everything here is about the Eightfold Path. It's about being kind, being good, being a better person, using that kindness in your meditation practice to deepen your peace and calm, right? And then contemplating the Dhamma in the right way, looking at the Buddhist suttas. All of this is part of the Noble Eightfold Path. What you're doing here is practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. That's all you're doing, really. Of course, when you are kind of sitting in meditation and you're fantasizing about this and that, then you're not really practicing the Eightfold Path. That's true. That part of it does not count. But whatever you do rightly, when you have the right attention, you're thinking in the right way, you're practicing the right way, all that is the practice of the Eightfold Path. This is what you're doing here. This is what it's all for. Right? So the Eightfold Path is not some kind of magical, strange. It's basically, everything that we do in life which is good and which is right. Okay. Okay, you said that people have no choice but to do what they are conditioned to do. There is no controller, no one in charge. What then are we to make of ideas like volition and intention? How do we understand effort to improve ourselves? Are we not already going to do whatever we are conditioned to do here. In the best problem of free will. Right, okay. Well, the point is that, yes, there is volition and intention, of course. You can feel that inside of yourself, there's a volition or intention to do this and that. But the point is that the volition is largely conditioned, right? Why do you will a certain thing? Why do you intend a certain thing? And if you look inside of yourself, you can see that intention comes from your conditioning of the past. When you choose certain food, why do people in Sri Lanka choose Sri Lankan food and people from the West choose Western food? It's not because there is much free will, it's because that's what you've been conditioned to do. Sri Lankan people like Sri Lankan food, Westerners like Western food. It's natural. You have grown up with that, that's what your mother gave you as a child, so that's what you like. And life is like that. Life is, we choose according to our past conditioning. So yes, there is intention, but intention is essentially conditioned. And yes, there is effort, of course there is effort, and effort matters, but the effort that you put in is also conditioned. Why have you come here to meditate? It's conditioned by your faith and confidence in Buddhism, right? That's why you're here. So that effort is conditioned by something before. If Buddhism says that you should try to be wise, then that effort in trying to be wise and reflecting in a skillful way is conditioned by you reading the suttas, that this is the right way to practice. So there is effort, and effort is very important. The Buddha says, if you put in effort in the right way, you will get results. If you make no effort, nothing will happen. But the effort is conditioned. So effort matters, but it comes from conditioning on the outside. So the idea of free will, this is an interesting problem. It is one of those points you can debate, is there free will or not? I would say personally, I can't really see how there can be any free will. There's just all these conditions happening all the time. We are conditioned this way and that way. There is no room, as far as I can see, for free will. Other people would argue that there is. It's a difficult kind of argument, and I'm not sure how far, how easy it is to actually come to any final conclusion. But it doesn't matter so much. As an ordinary person, a putujana in this world, you have a sense of self. And that sense of self gives you a feeling that you have free will, right? Your experience of the world is that I can choose what I want to choose. So use that sense of, that experience. Use the feeling I can choose, and then choose wisely according to that. If in the ultimate sense there is no free will or there is free will, it doesn't really matter so much. The point rather is that we do our best with what we have. And one of the things we have is a sense of free will. So use that wisely here. And then you will be going in the right direction here. Okay, dear Bhante, since Sila, Samadhi and Panya are progressive in that order, why is it that the Noble Eightfold Path starts with Samadhitti, Sankappa, which relates to Panya, and since Sila is the mandatory initiation to Nirvana? May the Noble Triple Gem give you more strength and wisdom. Okay, it's very kind to say that. Okay, so what is the connection here between the different factors of the Noble Eightfold Path? And the point is that, yes, there is Sila, Samadhi, Panya, but there's also a little bit of Panya required at the very beginning to get started on the path. Why do you have Sila? Sila comes from Yoniso Manasikara. You have to reflect in a wise way to even get started, right? So a little bit of Panya is actually required at the very beginning. But this is not the deep Panya that we talk about when we talk about Sila, Samadhi, Panya. That's a different type of Panya. That is the Panya which is basically seeing the Four Noble Truths and attaining full awakening here. So all of these things, they have like different places, and different places in the suttas will, put the path together in different ways, will emphasize different things. But all of these things are very malleable and very kind of movable around. You often find, for example, that sometimes you have mindfulness first, and then comes energy in the practice. Other times you have energy first, then comes mindfulness. Sometimes you have sense restraint first, then mindfulness. Other times mindfulness first, then sense restraint. And the reason why this is because that these factors have different strengths and different qualities. So if you have sensory strength, then that will help you to develop mindfulness. But if you don't have any mindfulness at all, you cannot have sensory strength in the first place. So perfect sensory strength happens only as a function of mindfulness. So they work together, right? One can be said to come before the other, or the other can be said to come before the other one. So they work around each other. So it really depends on how you look at this path. There's just many angles and points of view of looking at this thing. And one of the things about the Noble Eightfold Path is that remember that the Noble Eightfold Path, when it is fully practiced, it starts with the right view of the stream entry. The right view is defined as the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, right? So really, the full practice of the Noble Eightfold Path is Panya first. It is the insight of the wisdom of the stream entry which enables you to practice the Noble Eightfold Path 100%. When you are a stream entry, it's not as if you have internalized the Noble Eightfold Path. It becomes part of you, part of your psychology, part of how you look at the world, part of who you are. But the Noble Eightfold Path that ordinary people practice is a path that you practice sometimes you don't practice it. It's much more kind of loose, right? And that panya, that samaditti, which is needed to actually practice the ordinary Noble Eightfold Path of ordinary people, is a very weak form of samaditti. It's a very kind of a feeble form which can change very fast. So it's a very weak panya, and that's why the real panya is the one which comes after samadhi. I hope that makes sense. I'm not sure if it's very clear what I said, but there's a lot of flexibility in this path, basically. Okay. So let's move on to the next one. Dear Bhante, please explain how to generate piti sukha. Okay. There's many, many ways of doing this, and sometimes if you have enough purity and you just watch the breath and you become peaceful, very often the Pitta Sukha just comes by itself. As you become peaceful, it starts to arise by itself, right? This is just one of the very simple ways. For many people, that doesn't work. And some of the contemplations that you find in the suttas again and again, and which I have also emphasized a little bit before, is what the Buddha always talks about, the different types of recollection, right? The chaganusati, recollection of generosity, the silanusati, the recollection of one's virtue, the buddhanusati, recollection of the Buddha, dhammanusati, recollection of the Dhamma, sanghanusati, which also includes kalyanamittanusati, reflecting on one's kalyanamittas. All of these are ways of generating. These are some of the main ways of generating piti, sense of gladness in your mind. And the Buddha recommends that. This is a practice. This is why I was talking about how to recollect the Buddha the other day. I was saying, how do we recollect the Buddha? What is a skillful way of remembering the Buddha? And you have to find a way that works for you, that gives rise to a sense of gladness inside, right? You think, wow, this Buddha is an amazing being. What a wonderful, how fortunate I am to live at the time when the Buddha's teachings are still here. And when you think like that, a sense of gladness that you have access to teachings that can reduce suffering, that can give rise to happiness in your life. You have this refuge. This is why it's called a refuge, right? It's a place you can go and you can find solace. You can find an understanding of the problems in your life, a solution to all these things. That is why it is a refuge. So what a wonderful thing that is, that there is such a thing as the Buddha and his teachings are still available in this world. These wonderful teachings that help so many people overcoming problems and attaining something beautiful and worthwhile in this life. So this is the way to think. When you think like that and you really understand what these teachings are about, then piti happens inside of you. You know, you feel like little shivers or whatever. And that's a good sign. Or reflect on your virtue. Reflect all the kind things that you have done, or just the practicing of the precepts, how that helps other beings to feel safe and secure. You know, just sit back and just allow some good thoughts to arise in your mind. What have you done in your life? What are all the good things? What are the virtues you've been practicing? reflect on some generosity that you have done. Sometimes we do kind things to others. Sometimes it comes spontaneously. You do something kind. And you know sometimes when you really do something kind, you feel pity right there on the spot, right? You feel happy right there because of the act of kindness. And that act of kindness that you did before that gave rise to pity, if you can think back to that particular act, because that was a powerful act, recollect that act. What did it feel like? What was it like? And then you can often re-experience that pity that you had at that time. So these are the ways to generate pity. And if you look at, I wanted to actually talk about this later on in the suttas. If you look at the way, the mechanics of meditation, it starts off, one of the first factors is like pamoja, which is gladness, then pity, right? And then the mechanics of meditation, it always starts from that. That is an essential part. And only from there do you get the true peace, the pasaddhi, then the sukha, then the samadhi. And that sequence is always the same in the suttas. So without piti, there cannot be any proper samadhi. This is very important. This is the psychology. If you want to read what the mind is supposed to be like, you read this transcendental dependent arising. It shows you how things, stage by stage, change inside of yourself. This is what you feel like in meditation. It tells you the psychology, the mental aspects, how you feel as you meditate. So piti is absolutely essential, and these are some of the ways of doing it. Okay, next one. To achieve mindfulness, do you recommend walking meditation? Any other techniques? Okay, mindfulness is tricky. Mindfulness is there's two basic ways of achieving mindfulness. And one of the ways is simply that you have to allow yourself time to relax, to be at ease. You know, you come from a busy life, and it takes time sometimes for the mind to really relax down and become peaceful. So giving yourself time is the first one. But the other way of giving rise to mindfulness, sometimes people think that if I use a bit of force in the meditation, remember all this thing about counting the breath and all these things. If it works for you, it's great. But very often, if you do that, you are applying too much force. And the mindfulness that arises is not a natural mindfulness. It is a mindfulness that comes through effort, using the willpower, basically. The ideal mindfulness is the mindfulness which is completely natural. You just sit back and you are there, you are present automatically. You don't have to use any kind of force, any kind of willpower. That is the best kind of mindfulness because it feels easy, it feels relaxed, it feels good. And that kind of mindfulness can only really arise with things like we're talking about before, piti, pamoja, the gladness of the mind. That is when mindfulness arises. Why? And the reason is very simple. If you feel glad inside, it's nice to be here. It feels great. You want to be here, right? Why do you want to be anywhere else if you're feeling glad in the present moment? If you feel depressed, then of course you are going to be all over the place. You're going to fall asleep. You're going to think about things. You're not going to be happy. Or if you have some kind of remorse, perhaps, or you haven't been doing good things. Because of all that, the mind is likely to go off into fantasy or whatever. So this is why the purity is so important. Purity gives rise to mindfulness. Because when you are pure, you have gladness inside of you. Gladness, you want to be here. If you want to be here, you're going to be mindful. So you find that these factors of mindfulness, gladness and energy, they go around each other. They're the same thing, basically. They're all part of the same aspect. When you're glad, you have energy. When you have glad energy, you're mindful. When you're mindful, you're glad, etc. So that is really the technique. Of course, it is also good to do meditation practice, like walking or sitting, because when you do that, you're allowing the mind to calm down. And then mindfulness tends to arise, right? But don't force it. Allow it to come by itself naturally. That is the best way of doing it. Okay, next one. Oops, it starts over here. Okay, dear Adam, this question concerns the use of electronic devices and other conveniences. Cars, airplanes, water filters, x-rays, machines, MRIs, etc. Gee, that's an interesting list in modern life. can these be considered as sensual desires? Sensual desire is something inside of you as a person, right? It is not... I think what you mean here, are the sensual objects, is probably what you mean. Are they objects of desire? And it depends how you use them, right? It is not an object of desire unless you make it an object of desire. Of course, a car can definitely be an object of desire. You know, you get your new car, a fancy, nice car, you know, the right brand with the right kind of upholstery inside and all these kind of things. And you can get very attached to a nice car. So in that case, certainly it can become an object of desire. But if you use it just as for convenience, from getting from A to B, not really caring what kind of car it is, or what kind of plane it is, or what kind of x-ray machine it is, it's not really an issue. You just use them for their purpose, and you leave it at that, right? So it is how we relate to things is important. Things in themselves are nothing. It is how you relate that matters. So if you have a desire for these things in a kind of unwholesome way, then yes, then it becomes an object of sensual desire. For instance, is the use of a smartphone, the internet, video, audio recorders, as used here, a form of succumbing to sensual desire? It depends, again, on exactly on how you use it, right? If you become really attached to this video camera over here, and you think, oh, what a wonderful video camera, please treat it carefully, whatever. If you become very attached to it, it can become an object of sensual desire. But in itself, it's just a video camera. And the same is true for smartphone or the internet. You can use the internet wisely, or you can use it unwisely. If you use it unwisely, certainly the internet can become something very addictive, right? You can use all day on the internet if you once you get hooked on these kind of things. So it is all about how you use these things. And I myself, I use the internet sometimes. At the Buddhist Society of WA, we have an internet site. And that site, if used correctly, is very good for spreading the Dhamma, right? Lots of people around the world, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people, listen to the talks on the Buddhist Society website. So that's a wonderful thing. Then you are using technology in a way to reach people, to be able to teach them some good Dhamma, and to actually be able to spread this. After all, this is a wonderful message of Buddhism that we're able to spread in the world this way. So again, it's about how you use it, not the thing in itself. Ajahn Brahm's talks are easily available. They are over the internet, exactly. I use my laptop, my smartphone, etc. to access them, store them, and listen to them. But I use my electronic devices for all other purposes as well. Phone calls, emails, work, etc. Regardless, I have the desire or need to use or own modern electronic devices. Is this sensual desire? Can we draw a fuzzy gray line based on intention of use? There is certainly probably a degree of desire there because you want to use these things. And yes, there's probably some degree of attachment. Is it sensual desire? Yes, I suppose it is. You're probably getting some kind of sensual gratification, perhaps. Some kind of gratification anyway. I'm not sure if it is exactly what kind of desire it relates to. It will really depend on the situation, I suppose. Sometimes people are too idealistic about the practice of Dhamma. We want to be the perfect Buddhist. We're not supposed to have any attachments, right? Often I hear Buddhist people say this thing, oh, I'm a Buddhist. I shouldn't have any attachments. And I say to them, you know, you are aiming too high. How can you say such a thing? You are a human being. You're not awakened. You are going to have attachments. End of story. You cannot say to yourself, I'm not going to have any attachments. This is what happens during the practice, that you give up attachments. Remember that as long as you have a sense of self, and that is what you have until you attain full awakening, you're also going to have attachments. A sense of self and attachments go together, right? So don't go around, thinking I shouldn't have attachments. If you do that, you just feel guilty and you feel bad because you're aiming too high. Rather, what we should do instead is try to change our attachments to wholesome and good things. Try to be attached to a bit of sila, be attached to listening to a Dhamma talk every now and again. Not very attached, but a little bit attached, right? If you have no attachment to sila, you probably won't have any sila. If you have no attachment to listening to Dhamma talks, you probably won't listen to them. So a little bit of attachment in those areas is good. And by having a little bit of attachment there, you can lessen your attachments in the other areas of life where you should not be attached. For example, to electronic devices. So it's not good to have too much attachment to electronic devices, but use them wisely. Use them well. Don't aim too high. Start off by just being a good person in daily life. Do a bit of meditation practice. Try to improve yourself. Don't be too worried if you have a little bit of attachment like this. Okay. Next one. Okay. Question number one. I am a bit confused about the definitions of vitakka and vichara given by some text. Is vichara a synonym of the mind in the attempt to attain the first jhana, and vitakka the attempt to restrain the straying mind? Is there anything more to vitakka and vichara? Yes, there is more to it. Vitakka and vichara are interesting words because they have a very broad kind of meaning in the suttas. But the basic meaning of vitakka and vichara are thinking. In particular, vitakka has this meaning, it means to think, right? So we have seen in the suttas today, we have read about unwholesome thoughts of ill will, desire, sensual desire and harming, and these are called vitakka, right? It's a thought, basically, nothing but that. And then you have the good thoughts about kindness and metta and these kind of things. So that is the basic meaning of vitakka. And vichara has a similar kind of idea. But remember that the idea of a thought, what is a thought? A thought is the mind moving, right? The mind is moving in a certain direction, producing a thought. Is it intention? Is also part of it. So it is very broad in meaning. It can mean anything from the most coarse thought to the most refined thought. So where does that end? What is the most refined kind of thought you can have? And this is what you have to reflect on. And the most refined thought you can have, because thought is basically movement of the mind, is the very last vestige of movement in the mind. That is the most refined thought that is possible. So when you know in the suttas that in the second jhana it says vitakka vichara vipassama, that is the second jhana, the calming of vitakka and vichara. So once you come to second jhana, they are completely gone, right? So if vitakka means movement of the mind, it means that in second jhana there is no movement of the mind. And it also means that the first jhana must be the very last movement of the mind that is possible. Because the first jhana must be the most refined vitakka vichara that is possible. Because in the second jhana it's all gone, right? So because we're moving through samadhi becoming more and more refined, the first jhana must be the most refined version possible of vitakka vichara. That gives you some idea what it is. It's a movement of the mind that is very, very refined. That's essentially what it is. So it has a very broad kind of idea. So I think in the Visuddhimagga, they talk about the difference between vitakka, vichara, and they say that vitakka is the thing which moves the mind towards the object, and vichara is that which sort of holds on to the object, or something like that. Perhaps, that might be, maybe that is a good definition. But essentially they mean that there is a slight movement of the mind there. And it's interesting because you can, as I said before, you can read the Pali Suttas, you can also read the Chinese Agamas, and they're almost exactly parallel, sometimes word for word parallel to the Pali, which is very fascinating. And in the Chinese Agamas, you actually find that the words for vitakka and vichara are translated in one way in the jhana, for the jhana state, for the first jhana, and in a different way when it means ordinary thought, right? Which is interesting. And this, of course, these translations happened some 1,600 up to 2,000 years ago. That's when these translations happened into the Chinese. So they were very aware at that time that these words have different meaning depending on context. In the first jhana, it means something very refined. In ordinary speech, it basically means ordinary thought. So I think that, to me, that makes very good sense, that you have this big, broad meaning of these particular words. And the context decides what precisely they are referring to. Okay. Second question. What is implied by piti in the first jhana? Does it follow vitakka and vichara? In the alternative, do they arise independently? Piti is something that starts to arise, just like vitakka vichara is there all the time. Piti arises long before you get to the jhana state. But the piti transforms itself, right? As you move into more and more profound samadhi, the piti changes, becomes more refined, becomes more, more subtle, etc., as you move towards jhana. So this is something you take with you as you practice. So piti arises quite early, and then it is transformed. The same with vitakka vichara. It is quite coarse in the beginning, the mind is still moving quite a lot, and it becomes more and more refined, more and more still, until in jhana it is almost imperceptible. It's a very, very tiny remnant left of that movement. So they all go together, they all get more refined together, and they become true jhana factors at the moment you enter the jhana itself. Do they arise independently? Yes, because remember, vitakka vichara is always there, right? This is something we have in the mind almost all the time. Piti is not always there. How do you recognize when piti arises? Okay, well, you know, because it's happy. It's a happy feeling inside, right? You feel joyous. It's like a sense of joy. Often in meditation, it can be quite a coarse form of piti. It's like waves of pleasure going through the body, for example. That's often how you can feel piti. That's a very coarse form of piti. It's a very early stage. But you feel this pleasure going through the body. Piti. And pamoja, which is like the gladness, that's also a kind of piti, really. You know, sometimes you walk around and you feel the peace and you feel a kind of gladness inside of you. Wow, how wonderful this is. And just that feeling of gladness is already a kind of weak form of piti starting out. So it's all about happy feelings inside. That's what piti is. I'm sure you will recognize it when it's there, if you haven't had it already. Okay. Venerable Ajahn, Venerable Metta-Vihari, he's not here, so you've got to ask me this one. Sorry about that. Okay. Please consider extending the morning sutta explanation to 1.5 hours. Okay. The suttas at Bodhinyana Monastery is always 1.5 hours. 1 hour passes too soon. Can't we cover all? Okay. I'm very, very glad to hear that you are so keen on the suttas. I think the point is that here, because we have 6 days and we have 2 sessions a day, we have actually quite a lot of time altogether, you know. So here we don't have to stop at the end of the sutta, we can actually just continue in the afternoon session or the next morning. And that is the nice thing about being here. You're going to kill me if you try to extend this even more. And the other thing that I also find is that if you teach for too long, after a while your ability to attend to what is being said starts to decline quite rapidly. I think they say that usually 20 minutes is enough for most people. So already by doing 1 hour, we're already stretching it quite a bit. So I, personally, if you will forgive me for saying so, I would like to keep it to 1 hour. So I hope you are okay with that. I think we should still be able to do lots of suttas. We have another many, many hours left on this particular retreat. Okay. Was there anything else on that one? No. Okay. Okay. How best to stop the defilements from arising? And how best to let go? Does the environment matter? Yes, the environment does matter. It's nice to be in a peaceful place, right? That's why we come here to Bandaravela. We stay here rather than staying in Colombo or staying in a big city. If you ever came to Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth. We have a retreat center there as well, which is also in a very peaceful and nice surroundings. I know some of you have already been there before, and it's a very beautiful setting for a retreat center. Quiet, probably even more quiet than here actually, because there's no houses, there's nothing. There's just kind of Australian bush. So that is ideal, because then you can kind of really relax, right? It's very nice when the environment is peaceful. In Australia, I live in a little cootie in the forest. I can't really see anybody else where I live, just by myself. And it's always nice to come back to your cootie and just relax in your cootie. Everything is peaceful. There's nobody there, nothing happening here. How wonderful that is. So the environment does matter, but the environment isn't everything, of course. It's also how you apply yourself is also very important. So how to stop the defilements from arising? Well, that's what basically I've been talking about today here. You have to understand the danger in the defilements, that they're going to lead to problems for yourself. And once you understand the danger, then you have an incentive to look in a different direction. You see anger coming up. You know this is going to lead to harm and trouble. Okay, I don't want to go that way. Let me see the good in this person instead. Let me have compassion for this person instead. Let me try to look at the world in a different way, right? That is how you stop the defilements. You see the danger. Once you see the danger, you have an incentive, and then you learn a new way of looking at that situation, and the defilement doesn't arise. When it comes to sensual pleasures, it's more difficult because it is more deep-seated, more deep-rooted, and it's harder to see the danger in sensual pleasures. But that too, you can actually see. I was talking about that earlier today. Understand the danger. Once you understand the danger, you learn to look at whatever object you have desire for in a new way. You don't take it so seriously anymore. You don't think of it in the same way. And you have more equanimity towards it. So I don't think I want to go into too much more detail about that. And then how best to let go, exactly. Well, letting go is a bit like overcoming the defilements or anger, right? So what is the best way to let go? It's actually an interesting question. Sometimes people say, oh, you know, I can't really let go. How do you let go? And they feel kind of desperate. They feel they're sitting there and they can't really relax properly. They can't let go of the will or whatever it is. And the way the Buddha explains that letting go is the first thing you have to do is you have to understand that something is suffering here. When you understand that something is suffering, that is when it becomes possible to let go of that thing here. So if you have anger, you understand it's suffering. If you have a body and you want to let go of the body, then you have to understand basically that the body is suffering here. When you understand that something is suffering, then letting go becomes much easier here. So reflect on the suffering of these things. Reflect on the problem that they cause you. And then letting go can happen. This is called the Adinavasanya in the suttas, the perception of danger in something. And that allows you then to let go. It's just like, often they say, if you have like a hot plate, a hot plate in your house, and the plate has just been turned on, then you're not aware of the fact that it has been on. And by accident, you put your hand on the hot plate. Now, you don't have to think, should I withdraw my hand or not? It happens automatically, right? Oops, quickly. You don't even have to think at all. It's an automatic reaction. And it's the same thing with suffering. If you understand that something is suffering, you don't have to think, should I withdraw my hand? Should I withdraw my attention? If it is a deep understanding, the mind automatically withdraws from that thing because it understands that it's suffering. So this is how you let go. You learn that something is suffering. You see it as something dangerous. Then the mind withdraws. Then you can let go. Okay, dear Bhante, yesterday you mentioned not to have objectives as reaching samadhi. Okay. So you mean like having an objective of reading samadhi? Okay, jhanas or attainments. I assume objectives or intentions are adhitanas. Is that correct? Okay. A second one, aren't adhitanas important to direct one's virya, to direct one's energy here? And three, what are the suttas that explain adhitana virya, please? At times I feel I meditate without an aim. Okay? Adhitana, you can have an adhitana, you have to be careful. It's not, I think in meditation practice, it's not, I don't think it's useful to have an adhitana in meditation itself. I mean, if you're going to have an adhitana, then have an adhitana to say, I'm going to keep the five precepts, right? This is kind of a very useful adhitana. I want to keep the five precepts and make that a clear intention in your mind. But when it comes to meditation, we're trying to find peace. If you have too many adhitanas, usually there's too much will going on, too many things happening, and then it becomes difficult. So if you feel that the meditation is without an aim, well, you have to decide why are you meditating, what is going on, how are you using it. In ordinary lay life, often you cannot expect great results from meditation. You're not going to be experiencing lots of bliss every day. So use meditation in a different way. Use meditation just to relax, just to feel at ease. Remember, the most important thing in life is not meditation, the most important thing is sila. If you can keep your sila, your virtue well, then that is the most important thing, because that is the foundation for everything else. If you meditate but you don't practice sila, it's pointless. That is, if you practice sila but don't meditate, then that's actually much better. So use meditation to support your sila. Use meditation so you can relax, you can feel at ease. When you relax and you don't feel stressed, it's easy to be kind, right? If you feel stressed, it's very hard to be kind, because you're already all tied up and all kind of uncomfortable. But when you're at ease, it's easy to be kind to other people. So use the meditation just to relax and be at ease. Do a bit of metta bhavana if you can, because if you have metta towards others, it's easy to be kind to other people. So remember that meditation is like a tool. It has to be applied in the right way for whatever purpose you're trying to achieve. And this is, I think, a suitable purpose in lay life. If you are a good meditator and you can do more than that in lay life, wonderful, that's great. And I certainly, of course, encourage that. But for many of you who are too busy, don't aim beyond what is possible to reach in your ordinary life. So, understand why you're meditating, what you're meditating for. Here, when you come on this particular retreat, what you are aiming for, perhaps, is to do mindfulness of breathing, right? So you move towards mindfulness of breathing. But you have to understand when the mind is ready for that. If you start mindfulness of breathing too early, it's not going to work, because the mind isn't ready. You have to have a sense of mindfulness first. You have to have the factors coming together. Then the mindfulness of breathing will work. So you start off just by relaxing, taking it easy, just being present. Just being able to observe, just sitting back. And that's already quite a pleasant state, just observing, not reacting to anything. And then when the mind starts to become peaceful, then you start watching the breath. So you have to have a clear, you have a clear idea of the sequence, you have a clear idea of what you're doing, the sequence to things, but you don't necessarily have an adhitana. What you do is you just remember the instructions in the back of the mind, and then the mind sort of guides you through that sequence by itself. Right? That is how you have an aim, not by having adhitana. And then sometimes the meditation goes well, sometimes it doesn't. But because you haven't got an adhitana, it doesn't really matter. You're happy with whatever happens. And some days it is great, other days it's not so good. And all that is okay. Okay. Aren't adhitanas important to direct one's virya? I don't know if it really is required. I'm not sure if an adhitana as such is required. I think you direct your effort. You just know how important it is to be kind, right? You know that already in your heart. And because of that, you direct your effort towards kindness, kind thoughts, kind actions, towards generosity, towards metta, towards karuna, all these kind of things. If you make an adhitana, it's like using willpower. But instead, you try to understand why these things are important. You try to reflect that these things are important. And then that is a much more powerful way of doing what is right, of directing your virya, if you like. What are the suttas that explain Aditana and Virya? And there isn't many suttas that talk about Aditana. It's not really talked about very much in that way. You don't really find that. Aditana is one of these paramis, or paramita, that are talked about in later Buddhism, developed in the commentaries. They talk about the 10 paramitas, and in those 10 paramitas there is an Aditana parami, if I remember correctly, but I'm not... Isn't there? Yeah, there's one. That's one of the paramis. But that is a later kind of teaching. It doesn't come from the Buddha himself. So maybe you're mixing up two different categories of teaching there. I prefer to teach from the suttas and not so much from the later literature, because I feel the word of the Buddha is what really matters. Okay, I hope you're satisfied with that. I will... Just only two more questions. We might go a little bit over time, but that question is very easy. That helps. So we'll just do the last one, and then we are fresh for tomorrow. Bhante, in the morning talk, I think that must have been yesterday, because I'm bottom of the pile now. So in the morning talk, you said, confidence leads to knowledge. Could you please elaborate on this with examples? May this good karma lead you to, and the organizers of this retreat, to enlightenment soon. That is very kind of you to say that. Confidence leads to knowledge in the sense that we start off with confidence, right? You read the suttas, you get a sense of confidence that these things are good, and then eventually, through that confidence, you pursue the practice, you practice in the right way, and eventually it leads to knowledge. My point really was that it's important to differentiate between confidence and knowledge. If somebody challenges you about rebirth, for example, some person, rebirth, you know, superstition or whatever. Sometimes, particularly in the West, people will think that sort of thing. So do you get upset if somebody says that? Well, the reality is that you probably don't know whether there's rebirth, right? You may have certain indications that there is. You have heard perhaps people say that there is rebirth. Perhaps you have heard somebody who can remember a past life, or you have heard about children who remember past life. Maybe you think there are very good reasons for believing in it, but do you actually know it? And the truth is, no, you don't know it. And sometimes if you admit that you don't know, then other people challenge you. Okay, it's fine, you can challenge me, you know, I don't really care, it's okay, I don't actually know, so that's fine. So it's very nice not to have attached to these things too much, and think that we know things that we actually don't know. So remember that, okay, you have confidence, and maybe it is very well-placed confidence, but you don't actually know. We can admit that as Buddhists, that's fine. But one day, hopefully, you will know that there is rebirth. The whole purpose of the path is to move from confidence in these teachings, confidence in all these things, to move from that to knowledge of these things. That is the whole purpose of the Buddhist path. And that is a very, very different idea from almost all other religions. In other religions, confidence or faith is the goal and aim in itself. There isn't much movement after that. In Buddhism, confidence and faith is just the starting point. And then we actually want to find out for ourselves whether that confidence and faith is well placed. And that is what we find out through the practice. And that is what this shorter discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint is all about. It shows you how you move from confidence to knowledge. Okay, enough for this evening here. So let us end, as usual, by paying respect to the Triple Gem there.